If you wish to become a complete and wise leader, you must embrace a larger view of the Force.
Welcome, everyone. My name is DeVore, and you are listening to episode 40 of A Larger View of the Force, a Star Wars podcast.
Why are you laughing? It has been 5 seconds.
I
told you. No, don't stop. I told you.
Okay.
From this point
forward, start again.
We can't stop. Was this a mistake?
Possibly.
I want this to stay in the episode so bad.
No one's going to listen to this.
I will. Take a deep breath. Just get through the intro and then we'll just wing it.
Okay. And welcome, everyone. My name is DeVore and you are listening to the episode. I don't know what's happening right now. Hang on. And welcome, everyone. My name is DeVore and you are listening to episode 40 of A Larger View of the Force, a Star Wars podcast. A reminder, as always, if this is your first time listening, please go and check out the earlier episodes of this show and make sure you're subscribed so you keep up to date with new episodes as they come out. Today's episode is a big deal for a couple different reasons. First, as I mentioned at the top of the episode, it is episode 40. And these are always kind of extra special episodes for me. These ones where we kind of mark the transition point, you know, going from the teens and the 20s into the 30s. And now we're going into the 40s. So, yeah, always like these episodes. So there's that. Also, this episode is coming out on the 2-year anniversary of A Larger View of the Force. Yes, all the way back. On August 1st, 2020, episode 1 of this show dropped. And so I just want to give a shout out and thank you to everyone who's been listening. Whether you have been listening since episode 1 from the very beginning, whether you hopped on board sometime in the middle, sometime between 2 and 40, or whether this is your first episode, or regardless of where you are on this journey, I am glad that you are a part of it and that you have taken some time out of your days, to listen to me and to the people that I have on talking about Star Wars. So that really warms my heart. So thank you for that. Unlike last year, I'm not doing like a special year look back. Instead, what I'm doing to mark the 2-year is I commissioned through Charlie Ashby, who did the logo, all the art for the episode, I commissioned a new piece to commemorate one of my favorite episodes from this past year, and that is the episode that I did on Marxism and Battle Droids, the episode Battle Droids Are Working Class. So I have a little piece of art that I did to kind of commemorate that one. It is up on Twitter. You may have already seen it prior to listening to this episode. And I've also put together some merch for it using that art. So you can see that if you go to the link in the episode description. This is for all of the episode descriptions, as you can find the link to the show's merch store. If you like the design, you can get it on shirts and stickers and buttons and other assorted things. So yeah, that is there. That is my way of kind of marking 2 years, as opposed to doing like a year two look back episode. The third reason that this is a special episode has to do with both the topic and the guest for the episode. So this episode, I'm going to be talking about Phasma, Captain Phasma, both the character of Captain Phasma and also Phasma the book written by Delilah S. Dawson that was published back in 2017 as part of the Road to the Last Jedi. This is one of my favorite Star Wars novels, and, you know, obviously, in this episode, we're going to get into talking about why it is. I think it is a very standout book. I think it's very unique in a lot of different ways. And again, that's something we'll get into in this episode. So yeah, we're going to talk in this episode about, you know, about this book, about what happens, the story and all that, what we learn about the character of Captain Phasma and how it kind of adds to the experience of the sequel trilogy. And as I teased, I have a very special guest joining me for that conversation. A fellow Phasma fanatic. She is a co-host on Followers of the Force. She is also the host of Starboard Dawn, as well as the forthcoming, at the time of this recording, the forthcoming podcast, Now This Is Lit, in addition to being a few other things. Meg, welcome back to the show.
I have learned two things about you in terms of podcasting that I never knew before, and one of them is that you talk with your hands while
yes,
you're podcasting, while no one else is watching, except for I'm watching because I'm sitting right next to you. This is
yes,
weird.
Yes, I'm sort of assuming that most listeners, you know, who are listening to the show, most of the audience is like us, terminally online, and knows us also from the online world in addition to the podcasting world. But in case you don't, Meg and I are married. So she is here, I am here with her, and we are recording this literally in the same room.
I have been on this show two times before, and neither of those times were we even dating. So
correct.
This is weird.
Exactly. Yes, you were last on here for, I think it was episode, I want to say 18? Something like that?
Something like
yeah,
that.
It was sort of the late teens is when
Trials
we did the episode
the
on
Saber.
Trials of the Darksaber. And yes, we were not even together at that point.
I mean, it was pretty soon after that.
Exactly. Yes, it was. It was pretty
soon
after. It's
a whole story I'm not going to tell on this podcast.
Exactly. Yes, because some things stay in the marriage.
Oh, God. Is this how this whole episode is going to be?
Yeah, probably.
Also, I think the listener should know that the dog is just like right on you right now. Like
yes,
she does not understand what is happening.
Yes, our dog Izzy is now licking my arms just profusely and my legs, is just totally confused about what mom and dad are doing. She's just kind of tried to get up on my lap or something. I don't know what just happened.
Welcome everyone to the chaos. This is everyday life, and now you just get to experience it, except for we're talking about Star Wars, so it's fine.
Yes, exactly. So as I mentioned, you know, we're going to be talking about the character of Captain Phasma, someone who we talked about a little bit back the first time you were on the show when we were talking about The Force Awakens.
That's right.
And so we can sort of kind of circle back to that conversation and talk a little bit about her more generally, our relationship to the character. And then, of course, as I mentioned, the bulk of this episode will be talking about the Phasma novel. So, yeah, that's a good place to start. Just sort of talk about our own history with and feelings about the character of Captain Phasma. So I'm going to hand it off to you for that first.
My feelings about Phasma are so complicated because I don't fully understand them still. Like, so many people are like, why is she one of your favorite characters? For a while, she was my favorite character. And then Bo-Katan just walked into my life and everything is different after that. But, it's hard to explain still for me because she's a villain. She's not in the movies very much. She has one book. She's in a few comics. That's it. So, like, why did I choose this character to be, like, my favorite? I don't totally know, but I do know. And I think we talked about this in that first episode that I was on. I was watching The Force Awakens, and within the first couple minutes, Phasma shows up. And she's a female stormtrooper. And she looks different than all the other stormtroopers. That's not something we had seen on screen before. And like, there were a lot of things about that movie that stood out to me and that I loved. But there was just something about this character that just appeared that I wasn't expecting, who just stands out and is authoritative and is so different. She really stuck out to me. And I really was convinced for the longest time that she had survived The Last Jedi. And that she was going to come back at some point. Even if she didn't come back like in The Rise of Skywalker, I was like, she's going to come back in a book. She's going to show up. It didn't happen. I should say it hasn't happened yet. That there is hope still. That there is a story that has not been told where we find out that Phasma survived, because she has survived once already. And as we're about to talk about and discuss in great length, she survived many, many things before that moment. And I'm sure that she's still out there somewhere. I know that this galaxy took place a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. But like, you know what? I have dreams.
Yes, definitely. This is very much a hashtag Phasma Lives podcast.
Yes.
She survived. She is out there. If we can get Boba Fett back, if we can get Maul back, if we can get Palpatine back, if we can get all the people who have come back. God damn it. We can get Phasma back.
That's what I'm saying. It's like you didn't see a body. She could have easily survived that. Like, they tried to make it look like there's no way she could have. I am not convinced.
No, me neither. No, she definitely could have made it out. And I believe one day we will see how she made it out. I have no doubt about that.
Someone needs to write it.
Exactly. One possible candidate for writing that is the one and only Delilah S. Dawson, who
yes.
is the author of 2017's Phasma. Look at that transition. Hey! Beautiful. Exactly. That's how you do it in the business.
You right and your there. Transitions, man.
Oh, wait. I should probably talk about my history with Phasma. Whoops. Okay. I just had that beautiful transition, and now I'm just going
to... What does Phasma mean to you?
God. Great. Yeah. So this is why I... This is why I'm not as good at this as I pretend to be.
I think you're so good at it.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so in terms of my own history and relationship with the character, my first memory or association with her was actually before the movie. It would have been, I have a distinct memory of the Force Awakens promo shots that came out that must have been in, I don't know, Empire Magazine, Rolling Stone, I don't know, one of those, Variety, I'm not sure. And I have the memory in my mind, or the image in my mind, of the shot of Phasma, and she must be in, I guess, that would have probably been like the ruins of Takadana or something, like she's just posing there. It's not a shot from the movie. Mm-hmm. But like in that same set that included the unmasked Kylo with the snowtroopers, like all those pictures, like mm-hmm. the very first shots that we got mm-hmm. from The Force Awakens. And I remember there's the shot of Phasma just kind of posing with her rifle there. And immediately, you know, she was a character who stood out for a couple of reasons, or kind of really two big reasons. One is, much as you were talking about, the distinct look, which is we have this stormtrooper-looking character, but she's in this chrome armor. So she naturally just is kind of eye-catching in that way. And then the other reason that she stood out was that she was a she. Mm-hmm. And that at that point, Star Wars really hadn't had in live action a prominent female antagonist. I mean, at this point, you know, of course, you had Asajj Ventress in the cartoons, both in the OG Clone Wars and then in the canon Clone Wars. But in terms of live action on the screen, that was not something that we'd ever seen before. And so that intrigued me immediately about her, but in terms of her potential to be a different kind of Star Wars character, or at least particularly a different kind of Star Wars villain from what we had seen before. And so, you know, as you mentioned, she doesn't get a whole lot of screen time, both in The Force Awakens and in The Last Jedi, which I do think is criminal both to the character itself and also to the wonderful, talented actress that is Gwendolyn Christie. Mm. I think there was so much potential that was just left on the floor with using her and having her in Star Wars. But yeah, so she was a character that from the jump, before we'd even gotten a minute of screen time or really knew anything about her, is a character that I was very, very interested in. And then ultimately, you know, getting the opportunity to read the Phasma novel, which I didn't do until it would have been last year, 2021.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that I read the Phasma novel, and then getting her backstory in there, learning more about how she came to be a part of the First Order and her life before the First Order makes her both gives more to her character, adds actual dimensions to the character that you don't really get in the movie mm-hmm. because she doesn't really have a kind of arc or story in the movie on her own. Really what we get from her is her connection to other characters, principally Finn. And yeah, I think does justice insofar as making her a unique standout Star Wars character in terms of what we get in the novel.
Yeah, it's the book is hard because like you learn more about why she is the way she is. But as we'll discuss, you still don't know a lot by the end, which when I finished this book the first time, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. In a good way, but also, yeah.
Yeah, so there we have our transition to talking about the Phasma novel.
Hey, did it again.
Second time's the charm, baby.
You rock.
Yeah. So let's do that. So when I did the notes for this episode, you know, I did the notes one way, and then as I've kind of been thinking about them subsequently over the week or so since then, I've kind of decided to structure the episode kind of differently from what I did in the notes.
Okay.
Because, like, so I have a kind of way of thinking about how stories work. And I sort of think in my head is that, like, stories work on two levels. There's, on the one hand, what happens in a story, and then there's what's the story's about.
Right.
And those two things are related but distinct.
Correct.
So most of my notes in terms of the Phasma novel that I have here are about the what happens in the Phasma novel. And, mm-hmm. of course, we'll talk about the what happens in the Phasma novel because I think a lot of interesting stuff happens. But I think I want to gear, or at least where I want to start the conversation and where I want to structure the conversation, is around the what is it about. Because I think it's about a bunch of different things. So I think a good place to start off first, and I remember in the times that, you know, we've talked about just about this novel, just you and I together outside of any kind of podcasting contest, I want to start with talking about the structure of this book. So I want you to talk a little bit about that, because I think this book, I mean, you've in terms of the pantheon, or, you know, the canon of Star Wars books, you are much more versed in it than I am. Mm-hmm. But even from my vantage point of having read a decent number of Star Wars books, this is a very uniquely structured story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So first of all, I'm all for an unreliable narrator. I'm here for it. Doesn't matter the story. I say that because the most interesting thing about this book to me and the way that it's structured is that you have your present day, which is Vi trying to basically survive while telling these stories to Cardinal. But then you have the stories, which take place in the past. And I just reread this book for this episode, and I hadn't read it. Last time I read it was 2017. So, like, I didn't remember a lot. It goes back and forth between the present and the past a lot more than I remembered. And it works. It has to kind of be that way, because you have to have your Cardinals learning more, but then you're not sure if everything that he's learning is true or how true is it. But, you know, following this path of Phasma and, like, understanding how she comes to be who she is, you kind of need that back and forth, because you need to understand, like, what's the most important things that we need to learn here? Because that's the only thing, that's the only parts of the stories that you're getting. A lot of Star Wars books don't do it like that. I think, like, the closest example I can think of at the moment is the Aphra audio drama, because that's, she's telling the story. She's kind of, like, going through the past and in the present. And you don't know until, like, the end, sorry for spoilers, that she's, like, she's basically, like, writing a letter or narrating to someone, but you don't know who it is until the end. It's kind of sort of like that. I really like this structure, because a lot of Star Wars books, you just start at the beginning and you're getting things from the perspective of, you know, what's happening in the moment, but you don't really get a lot of context throughout of, like, where it's leading to. But the fact that the Phasma novel goes back and forth like that, it just adds so much to what you're learning, because you're learning about Phasma as Cardinal is learning about her. So it's kind of like, it kind of pulls you in more because of that, because you only know the things that he knows for the most part.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, so I think that's definitely one of the kind of unique, really unique things about this book, is that kind of parallel plot structure. Mm-hmm. Because you've got the, you know, you've got what is ostensibly the quote unquote main story, which is the story of Phasma and her past and how does she become a part of the First Order. Mm-hmm. But then you also have the, what I call the B plot that's not the B plot, which is the story of Vi Moradi and Captain Cardinal, mm-hmm. which is Vi Moradi, a resistance spy fighter, I don't know exactly how you want to describe her, who gets captured by the First Order. She is taken prisoner by this Captain Cardinal guy who, like Phasma, has his own distinctly colored armor of red. I refer to, like, all of these. So Phasma, Cardinal, and then Commander Pyre from Star Wars Resistance, I refer to them collectively as the First Order Power Rangers.
Oh my God.
I'm convinced there are more of them out there.
And is there, like, a blue one?
Possibly.
Green one?
There may also be, like, a Megazord or, like, a God. Voltron, where they all come together.
I've never told you this, but my brother was, like, a huge Power Rangers fan, and so I've seen many, many of Power Ranger things. I'm with it. I'm here now. I'm right with you.
What you learn in the story is that he comes to discover that Vi Moradi had traveled to the planet of Parnassus, which is the homeworld of Captain Phasma, and he is eager to learn what Vi Moradi, he believes that Vi Moradi has learned about Phasma from being on Parnassus, because the context the book gives you is that pretty much Cardinal, before Phasma's arrival, he had been the kind of poster boy of the First Order. He had been the kind of main guy among the Stormtrooper Corps. He had been the kind of right-hand man to Brendel Hux, who was the Armitage Hux's father, so the Hux that we see in the movies. But then once Phasma comes into the First Order, his star kind of falls, And she kind of, she is risen up and she is held up as the model trooper. And she becomes the one who is literally, as the book talks about, she's literally on posters that are inside the First Order Star Destroyers. And all the little stormtrooper cadets and the kids are all looking up to her. And they all want to be like Phasma. And he kind of resents that. And he thinks that she really isn't this model for what a First Order trooper should be. And so he wants to get dirt on Phasma that will bring her down and kind of put him back up. And so it's from that context and his interrogation of Vimerati that you get the story of Phasma, which then kind of leads interestingly into the kind of the other aspect of this book that I think is really, really fascinating for how the story is structured, is that this is a story about Phasma that is not from Phasma's point of view.
Yes. Yes. And that's the, like, when I read this book for the first time, my brother kept asking me, like, are you learning more about Phasma? Are you learning more about this character? And I kept saying, yeah, but kind of not really, because it's not from her perspective. That's brilliant, because Phasma's whole thing is that you know her, but you don't. So you don't even get her backstory from her perspective, which is so frustrating as someone who wants to know everything about her. But like, this is all you're going to get.
Yeah, exactly. And like, It's even removed to even a greater degree than that, which is to say that this is not even a secondhand story. This is a third-hand story.
Yeah.
So this is Vimerati relaying to Cardinal what she has learned from one of the other major characters in the book, which is the character Siv, who knew Phasma when she was growing up. Mm-hmm. So this is Siv telling Vi, who is then telling Cardinal this story about Phasma.
Therefore, is the info you're getting really the info you need? Who
Precisely,
knows?
Yeah. So it is being filtered through all of these different characters who have different agendas in terms of what they are disclosing and what they are not. Because, of course, you know, as you see in terms of the, again, as I call it, the B-plot, that's not the B-plot, Vimerati is using the story to kind of string everything along. And really, I think that's one of the interesting things about the B-plot, which is that, like, it's on the one hand, it's the vehicle for us getting the story of Phasma, but then it's also Vi is using this as a way to kind of prolong her time with Cardinal to try and kind of turn him. So their dynamic is really interesting.
This book has so many layers, and like the more I like dig into it, the more brilliant it is.
Yeah.
It's just so good.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, you get what happens, you know, I think let's kind of, you know, I guess now we're getting a little bit into the, like, what happens apart from the, what is it about? But in terms of the actual story of Phasma's upbringing or the story of her getting into the First Order, because you have the quote unquote present day story that happens between Vimerati and Cardinal. And then you have the past story, which I think takes roughly about 12 years. I think most of it before the events of the present day, the mainline story. And so you are taken to the world of Parnassus, which you learn about as really this kind of post-apocalyptic hellscape.
God.
Is pretty much what you can describe it. So what you learn in the novel is that Phasma, prior to her time in the First Order, she and her brother, Keldo, were part of this group called the Skyer, which is pretty much this band of, I don't know, mostly kids, like not even kids, but almost like young adults is what you gather. Most of them are probably in their late teens or 20s, because one of the things it mentions is that most people don't live very long. And they are living in this cave, pretty much, in this kind of rocky area that's called the Nautilus. And they are more or less eking out an existence in this barren, inhospitable wasteland. And so I think that in itself also is, in terms of the unique contributions of this book, the setting of Parnassus, I think, very much stands out.
First, I need to say that Star Wars needs to work on naming its planets, because there are too many planets that sound the same and start with P, because I could not remember the name of Phasma's home planet. I'm like, it's not Passana. It's not Pantora. What is this planet's name? Because I thought, for some reason, I thought it was one of those two. And then I listened to the audiobook and I was like, I was so wrong. You know, one of the most important things about this particular setting is that from like at this point, we have only seen or we will only see on screen Phasma in this very orderly, clean, almost seemingly perfect environment. But then you go back and you realize that's the exact opposite of where she came from. And that explains a lot about why she comes to desire what the First Order can offer her. Because where she came from and the First Order are like as opposite as they could possibly be.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, there is a very sharp contrast drawn in the book between... And I mean, the contrast starts to be drawn as soon as we get the arrival of the Elder Hux in the story. And we will, of course, get to that. But yeah, this contrast between the very polished, the very sophisticated, the very technologically advanced First Order, where, yeah, you have all these ships and people in this armor. And like that's another thing that we get, and we can kind of get into this when we get back to the B plot. Like we get a little bit of like, what is life like within the First Order? You get some of that insight.
Right.
I think is really interesting. And then, yes, this very hard scrabble, barely surviving, eking out a life, utter desolation that you have on Parnassus.
Yeah. And like, it starts off, someone's being attacked. Like it just, you just get right into it.
Yes. Yeah. Cause you get the first, I think it is the first flashback chapter four, I think is one of the most standout chapters in any Star Wars book. And it is the chapter that the first time I read it, I genuinely had a moment where like after it, I paused and was like, I had to just take a moment to process what I had just read. Because what happened, you know, both as a refresher for those who have read it, and then I'll give a little insight to anyone who's listening who may not have read the Phasma novel, because we don't want you folks to feel lost in this conversation.
Yeah.
Is that you get this story where the leader of the Skyre is basically this kind of older guy who's kind of faltering and fading. And so one of the kind of upstarts, one of the guys who is trying to want to take leadership, goes in and kills him and tries to claim the mantle of the leadership of the clan. And then that's when Phasma and Keldo step in and basically refuse, because they argue that he took power in a dishonorable way by just turning around and killing this guy outright outside of like any kind of combat or anything like that. And so then a fight ensues between Phasma and this guy. His name is, I actually have his name written here. What is it? Por is the guy who...
Yeah.
Yeah. He is the pretender to the throne, essentially. And so he is then defeated in combat. He is allowed to live. And then what happens at the very end of the chapter is that we see Siv, who is pretty much our, not quite our narrator, but our information source. She procures a device that plays an important role in the story, a device known as, that is called the Traxer. And this is a device that is used to suck the essence out of the bodies of the dead, pretty much to suck out their bodily liquids. And these liquids are then used and turned into a kind of ointment, pretty much, that the members of the Skyre then put on their bodies, and that is used as a way to combat infection and protect their skin from damage and to heal wounds and things like that.
It's like, it's a great representation of like how they have come to like need to literally recycle every resource that they can. But oh my God, I can't, like, if it's all you've ever known, sure. But like, I can't imagine that being like, cause that's like her job. Like yes. That's what she's trained to do. That's what she is around basically to do. That's a lot. That's a lot to take in.
Yes. Yeah. She talks about how this was a technique that she had learned from her mother. The Traxers are described as this kind of ancient device that had kind of been passed down across generations. But yeah, that last thing was the part that made me pause after reading the chapter. I'm like, what? Just like they sucked like the fluids out of this dead guy?
Yeah.
It's so like, And I mean, this applies to so much of the book. Is like, you so often see, like, particularly on Twitter, like, every so often people talk about, like, oh, like, we should have an R-rated Star Wars. They should make an R-rated Star Wars. That exists. Go read the Phasma novel. Phasma novel's R-rated Star Wars.
I mean, we've only just started. Like, it gets, like, you think this beginning is showing chaos. Like, it just gets more chaotic as you go. And there's a particular part that stuck with me even after I read it the first time. You probably know which part I'm talking about. Like, I will never get it out of my brain, because if I had to watch it, I think that would be too much.
You know, I know what you're talking about. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes.
It's like, it's sad to me to think about how, like, even in this chaos that they're in, they're trying so hard to establish some kind of order. Like, there's like, you can't, that's not the way we do this. Or like, you can't kill someone and take the power. That's not the right way to do it. They're clinging to like any kind of sense of structure that they can, but there's none. Like, you can't control any of that. And that's so sad, because like, they're living in these terrible conditions, just trying to survive. And like, the things that they are trying to hold on to try to like give themselves hope almost, it's not enough.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you see that fleshed out both in that particular context, in that first scene where they're, you know, they're trying to set up some sort of leadership structure or succession, saying like, who can be a legitimate leader, who's not. You also see that in terms of how they deal with other clans.
Yeah.
Because a big part of the early part of the Phasma story is their relationship to a kind of rival tribe called the Claw. And that becomes this kind of source of tension, because after Phasma and her brother kind of depose this, you know, this pretender, her brother Keldo kind of steps into the leadership mantle, and you have this early conflict that emerges between Phasma and Keldo, where Phasma wants to go to war with the Claws and she wants to fight them for territory, but his stance is, we got to keep the peace, we need to have a truce and all that. So you're seeing sort of a lot of that kind of politics coming into the story there, too.
Yeah, it's a lot of like, Phasma thinks she knows the best way to do things always. And like, at this point in the story, there's someone who basically has the authority to tell her, like, that's not the way we're going to do it. We can't do it that way. And like, we'll get to a point as the book goes on where like, she becomes like, no one can tell her no. No one can tell her otherwise. And that becomes a problem.
Yeah, precisely. And, you know, the real kind of major turning point in terms of Phasma's early story, where we start, you know, the plot really kind of starts picking up, is when you get the arrival of the First Order. Because, you know, what happens is they see this ship that crashes down to the surface of Parnassus that they never really seen before, like anyone kind of coming to the planet. Phasma wants to go and investigate what this ship is, to figure out who it is or what it is. But it turns out the ship has landed kind of in the vicinity of the territory of the Claw. And so Kel was like, no, you can't go investigate the ship, because you'd have to cross over their territory and that's not allowed. And then Phasma pretty much just blows him off and goes off to investigate. And that is where we get the entry into the story of the Elder Hux, Brendel Hux, mm-hmm. who is revealed to be on the shuttle along with his merry gaggle of stormtroopers. And just like Brendel Hux, just like kind of set this up. I mean, you could even say this a little bit about the younger Hux, but like particularly Brendel Hux in the story, just as I'm like, it's just a real douche like throughout this entire story.
He's literally just like, why am I on this stupid planet? I don't want to be here, but I guess I need your help because I can't get back to where I'm supposed to be.
Yes. Yeah. He is just constantly like frustrated and like, why do I have to deal with these people? And just above everyone and everything else.
Yeah, or like at first, like they can't even really communicate because like their language is not quite the same, I think is what they say. So like, even at the beginning, he's like, I can't even like, I need like a translator droid to make this work.
Yeah, exactly. And so then, you know, what ultimately happens is, as I mentioned, Phasma, she disobeys Keldo's orders. She goes out and she finds Hux and the stormtroopers. She brings them back to the Skyer, and Keldo understandably is quite upset with her for disobeying his instructions. She is trying to sell Keldo on the First Order, because one of the things that Brendel says is, oh, you know, if you can help us, you know, get back to our ship and, you know, get a signal back out to the First Order, they can come, they can get you guys, we can bring food and medicine and supply, like, we have access to all this great stuff beyond. And Phasma's trying to sound like, look, we should ally with this guy, like, he can really help us out, like, he can get us the things we need. And then Keldo is just not really interested at all.
I mean, as he shouldn't be, because, like, we know as readers, First Order is not going to keep that promise.
Yes.
Ideally, you know, Brendel, sir, has no plans to follow through on any of that at this point.
Yes, precisely. And so then Phasma ends up, she pretty much takes a kind of group of her warriors, or warriors that are loyal to her, or members of the Sky that are loyal to her, among them Civ, and they, along with Hux and the stormtroopers, pretty much begin this journey across the Parnassus wastelands to get back to the shuttle so that Hux can send out the signal to call the First Order in. And so, you know, I think there's, you know, there's a lot of interesting conversations that start to happen, you know, as they're pretty much just trudging along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get, on the one hand, you know, you talked about how, like, they first have to kind of overcome this language barrier, because Hux only knows basic, they don't know it, and mm-hmm. so they gotta figure out a way to communicate. And then them learning from Hux, or picking up information about pretty much how the rest of the galaxy functions, because he comes to discover that they don't know basic things about politics and government. Like, all this stuff is unfamiliar to them.
Yeah, like, they don't even know, like, what the rest of their planet is like. Like, they only know the area around where they've always been.
Yeah, yeah. There's one point where he talks about how, like, when he's like, well, this is all a weight, like, this is all shit, pretty much, is like what he said. Like,
yeah.
But as we were flying in, we saw some parts that are forested and look like they might be inhabited, or they might have cities. And they're pretty much all like, wow, like, really?
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's like, you never really think about that, where it's like, say you, like, you grow up in a place and you're there your whole life and you don't really venture outside of that. Like, you don't know what anything else is like. And that's exactly how it is for them. Like, they don't know about, like, what kind of wars have happened at other places in the galaxy. They don't know the Skywalkers. Who are the Skywalkers? They have no idea, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And then you get a little bit through there where Brendel is kind of talking about the purported mission of the First Order, mm-hmm. or it's kind of raison d'etre, where he talks about how it is about, and you get a little bit of this politics also once we, you know, once we toggle back to it, we'll talk about in the context of Vi and Cardinal's conversations. But you get a little bit from Brendel where he's kind of talking up the First Order is, oh, we're here to bring order and civilization throughout the galaxy, to bring all of this technology and advancements to different parts, and to rule populations that cannot rule themselves, or that are incapable of ruling themselves. That is why the First Order exists.
I mean, like, sure, I guess it sounds fine.
Yeah.
We know.
Yes, we know. Yeah, we know exactly. But this is how he's kind of selling the First Order to these kids, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who he's found himself among. And what you start to see, and you kind of get this really through Civ's eyes, is she starts to document and to notice the ways that Phasma begins to transform as she is in the company of Hux and the other First Order. So there's that one point where she talks about how Phasma starts adopting the same kind of mannerisms and speaking as Hux. So starts kind of speaking very formally and clipped in the same way that Hux does.
Mm-hmm.
And so mimicking him in those ways. And I always think, you know, you mentioned that point about the unreliable narrator of it all, and the way that the story is filtered. You get several moments throughout the story where you have Civ and she's looking on, and the story talks about how she sees Brendel and Phasma kind of off to the side by themselves, and they're kind of talking, but she, of course, can't really figure out what they're talking about.
Right.
So it is that from that kind of narrative storytelling perspective, it's interesting because you are in this moment of you're getting just this limited information. You don't totally know everything that is happening.
Right. And it kind of adds a little bit of mystery because, again, like, there's only so much we're ever going to know about Phasma. And you just wonder in those moments, like, what are they talking about? Like, what is she asking him? Like, what is he promising her? You know, because it ends up being that, you know, as we kind of talked about before, like, once she gets off this planet, she is like the golden child. But like, how did she get to that point? You know, it's like, it's these little conversations they have. Like, what are they talking about?
Yeah, exactly. And that sort of adds to that allure of Phasma, or that element of the story that we've been talking about, where like, it's a book about Phasma, but you don't necessarily learn a whole lot about like who she is or what's happening to her internally.
Right.
You know, as they are going on this journey to try to get back to Hux's shuttle, and they're having these conversations about the larger galaxy and about all that, I think it is somewhere in here where we get the moment that you are alluding to, which is the moment that has stuck to you from this. I think it is here, right?
Are we talking about the Beatles?
We are talking about the Beatles.
Oh my God. Okay, so like, she, Delilah S. Dawson, you don't realize how good she is at describing things until she describes things you never wanted described to you. And the way she describes this character literally exploding is something I've never forgotten. It has been 4 years. 4 years? 5 years. I've just never forgotten it, because it's just like, it's also the way that it builds up. Like, it doesn't just happen instantly, and it just keeps getting worse and worse. And these Beatles are kind of like another example of like, taking advantage of all the resources that are available, because all they want is the moisture. And oh my God, I think about it way more often than I probably should.
Yeah. So the context for listeners is, what happens is, as they are making the journey through these planes, one of the Skyer members who came along with Phasma, this guy by the name of Carr, he is bitten by this little golden beetle that pretty much just comes out of the ground and bites him. And as they're going along, he starts to feel a little unwell initially. Like, he starts, like, he's coming down with some sort of disease or illness or parasite or something. Mm. And yeah, he's not doing great. And then all of a sudden, his condition just rapidly deteriorates. He just starts feeling like terrible, terrible, like he's completely just crashing. And then it climaxes in dramatic fashion where pretty much his body turns into water, like liquefies, and then he explodes.
Oh, God.
So it's literally like the scene with Senator Kelly in X-Men, for those of you who have seen the first X-Men movies. Like, literally, like, there was like a Senator Kelly scene in this movie.
I don't, like, I love this book. I don't want to see this on screen. I don't. Please.
Yeah, he pretty much blows up in the liquid. I think there's still some of his like bones or whatever.
Yeah,
and then like a bunch of beetles come out of the ground and start like gobbling up his remains. Like, it's so just, again, it's one of several moments in this novel where you're like, what did I just read? And
yeah,
would absolutely be R-rated if you put this on a screen.
Exactly. Like, I second your motion. If you want R-rated Star Wars, read this book. Like, listening to the audiobook is like a step above that. Like, that's a little bit closer to getting it on screen. Like, highly recommend, but also, I'm so sorry. Don't read this book at night.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, as they're making their way through the plains of Parnassus and they're trying to get to the ship, they start coming across other areas or other regions or other places that they hadn't before, and start to learn more about Parnassus. So you get particularly these two locations that are quite interesting, where a lot of things happen in the kind of middle of the book, where you get, on the one hand, you get Terpsichore Station, mm-hmm. where they stop. And their cause for stopping there is, I think Hux was originally, when his shuttle crashed, he was injured. And so he's pretty much kind of been like carried along this whole time. Mm-hmm. And they come to this station, which had been formerly run and operated by a mining corporation that had been on the planet many years prior to the events. I think ultimately the story reveals, I think it's like a century before the events that are happening here. And he is brought in to be treated and healed. It turns out that the station, like all of the droids that were originally there are still there, and the medical droids there start working on Hux to try to fix him. But then it ends up being this like whole plot where they don't have any way to pay the droids for the medical services. And so then Phasma and company have to start pretty much working for the droids. I think they're working as like miners or something for the droids. Yeah. And so like I think that's an interesting element of, you know, it kind of adds to the kind of post-apocalyptic environment of it all, where you've got these places that are kind of frozen in time.
Yeah. Yeah, I forgot about the middle parts of this book. Like, I don't know how, but it's like they're so interesting because it's them discovering like the way of life that we've been living. It's very different than this, but it wasn't necessarily better or worse. You know, like you start to find out like all over this planet, everything is terrible.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And you, as the story goes, you get towards the end, you kind of learn how Parnassus came to be the way it is right now. And so, you know, you've got all the experience on the Terpsichore station. And then once they manage to get out of there, the next place that they end up in is R2 station. Where you kind of discover it's the kind of other spectrum of the kind of post-apocalyptic environments where like at the beginning of the book, you get the first end, which is desolate wasteland, bands kind of just living on their own. It's, you know, very kind of Planet of the Apes-y. Like you just get the few people who are kind of eking their way out. Mm-hmm. And then R2 station is kind of on the other end of the band, which is it's all of these people stuck in this one place. And it's this kind of Hobbesian struggle for resources, this kind of state of nature. Everyone is kind of out for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, this part was interesting to me because like you have more of like you got it in the beginning too, where there's kind of like a system where like, here are the leaders and then here are the people who are kind of the warriors and the kind of people who are just there. And you get a lot of that more here, and you just see like how low the lowest people on this hierarchy actually are.
Yeah. Because, you know, of course, like a big theme of this story, or a big kind of through line of this story, is about survival and adaptation and how do you survive in extreme circumstances. And you get one version of it among the Skyr and the way they operate and all the stuff with the Detraxers and all of that. Then when you get to R2 station, you see a totally different system, where what you learn at R2 station is that the big problem there is overpopulation. There's too many people. There's not enough resources. There's particularly not enough food to go around. And so the way that the R2 station has developed to survive, to kind of keep things going for as long as they can, is you have this figurehead, this ruler of the R2 station, which is known, who is called the R2. And pretty much what happens is that the population of R2 station is kept distracted through these, pretty much these kind of gladiator style combat tournaments that take place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's like we've talked about this book being R-rated Star Wars. Like it gets pretty nasty here because you're fighting to the death.
Yeah. So that's pretty much what happens, is that as Phasma and everybody else is traveling, they are captured by warriors from R2 station, and they are brought in and they are made to serve as gladiators, essentially, as warriors, as part of these tournaments. And they are brought in to fight against this one guy who's called Wanderous, this like the kind of prize champion warrior. And pretty much the objective of these combat tournaments, as is kind of explained to Phasma and Hux and everybody else, is the objective they have to do as the warrior is pretty much keep the R2 happy.
Yeah.
You have to fight in a kind of manner that is ostentatious or entertaining enough that he is happy and will keep you around.
Yeah, like don't kill your enemy right away. Keep things going as long as possible. Get hurt, but not like too much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's very much it's both fighting, but then there is this kind of staged element to it. There's a kind of theatricality to it all, where if you are entertaining enough, if you please the R2 enough, then you will be given food and you will be given, you know, you will get resources in order to stay alive. But if you do things that displease the R2 or you're boring to him, then you're shit out of luck, essentially.
You're pretty much.
Yeah. And so, you know, what you find out there is when they are, you know, they first, like, their first time in the arena when they're brought to fight is pretty much Phasma gets the shit beaten out of her. Like, it's just a total defeat for them. But they, again, you know, to that element, it still is pleasing. It's still entertaining. And so they are, you know, they're given some food and they are allowed to, you know, have a second chance. And then when they go to, when day two happens and they have their rematch with Wanderous, that is where you get the other, I think, very dramatic high moment that happens in this story.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have Phasma on the one hand, she kind of devises this strategy for taking down Wanderous and defeating him and killing him. And then, in the way that Delilah S. Dawson describes it, in very dramatic fashion, Phasma, she's got this sword that she's given to fight. They pretty much just throw these weapons into the arena. She, with the help of one of her other warriors, like, hurls herself out of the arena and then decapitates the R2.
Yeah, I had forgotten a lot about the middle of this book, so, like, rereading it again, I did not see that coming, and I was like, you know, that's such a Phasma move.
Yeah, exactly. She just goes straight in for the kill.
Yeah.
And it's this really poignant moment because on the one hand, yeah, it comes out of nowhere because she even has this moment where, you know, she's taken down Wanderous and the crowd is all cheering and they're happy and she's pretty much like, you want to see something else? And they're all like, yeah, and they're cheering. And then she does the move and she goes out and chops his head off. And then there is this moment where, like, everyone else in Phasma's company, they're all, like, watching. And even the crowd is, like, stunned in a moment. And everyone's like, what's about to happen? Is it going to be total mayhem? Are they all going to go on Phasma? Like, are they all dead? And then instead what happens is the crowd just erupts into cheer.
My God. They're entertained. Like, they don't even see each other as people anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Because, and that's one of the things that you come to discover subsequently in the story is, like, when you meet the R2 first, he is presented as this almost like godhead.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he is this leader they're all following. And then what you come to learn subsequently is, oh, he's trapped in the system too.
Yeah.
And you learn that subsequently where it's like, you think somebody, maybe it's Phasma, maybe it's Huck, someone else asks, like, well, what happened to the prior R2? And it's like, oh, he was too boring and the other people just, like, killed him. Like, the crowds just turned on him and, like, ripped him apart.
Yeah, it's like everyone who's trapped here is just, like, so desperate for some kind of escape, even though a literal escape is not what they can have.
Yeah, exactly. And because, yeah, I think, again, another one of the characters, one of the residents of R2 Station kind of puts it that way, that they are just trying to prolong things as long as possible. There's really no kind of hope of things getting better. It's pretty much how long can we maintain the status quo before everything just completely falls apart.
Speaking to me a little too real right now.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
Everything's fine.
Yeah. It's like, you know, because, you know, in a story and in a franchise that is so defined by hope, mm-hmm. that is hope is one of these things, like, to see an environment, to be in a place that is so devoid of any kind of hope. Like, mm-hmm. None of these people think there's any kind of future where things get better.
Yeah. Well, that's why they are kind of hopeful in the sense that, like, Hux has promised them they're going to get out of here, right? Like, whether they believe that or not, like, that is a promise that has supposedly been made to them. They want to get out of there so bad because there is no other hope. And they know that. They may not want to admit it, but they know it. And the fact that, like, that's, like, possibly the only hope that they're clinging to this whole time just makes the story even more tragic than it already is.
Yeah, precisely. And after the events of R2, once they leave there, because there's a whole plot where pretty much the residents of the station try to turn Phasma into the new R2.
Yeah.
And then she's been like no, in pieces.
Yep.
And they end up leaving, and as they are traveling, again, making their way further along, try to get back to Hux's shuttle, they learn subsequently that what had happened on Parnassus is that the planet had once been a hospitable, habitable planet. It once had been fertile. There had been life and all, like plant life, animal life, and all that. But that this mining company that had set up operations on Parnassus, Constar, had caused some sort of nuclear accident, or there had been some sort of leak or whatever, and that had pretty much destroyed the planet. And so then they pieced and then left everybody who was there to their fate.
Yeah, and that's why they can't get the nutrients that they need. That's why they can't, like, basically survive. That's why they're all dying.
Yeah.
Which is so, like, it's so sad. It's even worse because, like, this terrible accident happened, and then they just left. They're like, nope, good luck.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. It makes me so mad.
Yeah, they pretty much kind of wipe their hands clean of the whole situation and then end up leaving. Which, again, if you think about, like, larger Star Wars storytelling, there is that kind of element to various Star Wars, that kind of, like, anti-corporate bend to some of them. Where they're, like, particularly when you get back, when you go into the prequels and you see some of that. Like, I think the story that you get here with Constar and, this whole element of, oh, they caused this big disaster, they ruin this planet, and then there's no accountability, they just leave.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah. And so as they kind of get close to Hux's ship, the other members of the Skyer catch up to them. So you got Keldo and pretty much everyone else that they had abandoned catches up to them, and then you have this big battle that takes place where pretty much it happens on the one hand, most of the Skyer is wiped out, like, in the midst of this fighting, and then you also have Phasma killing her brother.
Even at this point in the story, she's trying to do two things at once, and they both involve elimination. She's trying to get rid of anything that might stand in her way of getting what she wants, but she's also trying to completely cut herself off from her past. So, like, anyone that she knows, like her brother, for example, like, she doesn't care. She's like, I'm done with you. I'm done with all of this. Like, you are trying to prevent me moving forward, and therefore you must die.
Yeah, exactly. And so then Hux, he gets the signal out to the First Order. They send a Star Destroyer. They send a shuttle down to rescue everybody. And he's about to go on, Phasma's about to go, and then you have this really poignant moment where Siv is about to go along with them, and then Phasma prevents her from going on. Because there's some context earlier in the story where, back when they had been in R2, Phasma had given Siv an order when they were fighting the Wanderers in there, and then Siv had kind of disobeyed her, and then Phasma kind of retaliates in this way by saying that Siv is too weak, she doesn't follow orders, and so therefore she is not going to cut it, essentially, in the First Order.
When I got to this part the first time I read it, I think this is a part where I actually stopped. You know, I was like, you have got to be kidding me. Like, this character was so close to getting off this goddamn planet. She's stuck there forever.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, after Phasma, goes with Hux and she gets up on the Star Destroyer, you know, you get, I think, the other really poignant moment in the Phasma story that happens here, where they are in the Star Destroyer above Parnassus and they're kind of looking down at the planet. And then Hux orders, pretty much has two shots fired down, where he, on the one hand, destroys the Nautilus, so pretty much the kind of headquarters, the home of the Skyer, and then he sends out another blast and destroys R2 station. And pretty much his entire purpose in doing this to Phasma is to demonstrate the power of the First Order. It is pretty much him way of saying, pretty much he's like, don't fuck with me or the First Order.
Yeah. Man. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that part too. And I was like, just, you know, you're just like the Empire. You just want to destroy everything just because you can. And she's basically already one of them by this point.
Yeah. And yeah, it was just, again, it was another poignant moment in this way of like, you know, back to the point that I talked about a few minutes ago about like the hopelessness, like on Parnassus and the way that like life on the one hand, like there's a way in which life has value, like particularly in the sky, or like a big point that they make is about how there's very few young people in the Skyre, and there's like at the beginning there's like one kid in the Skyre. It was like I don't know, she's like five or something, and like everyone is super protective of her because she's like the only kid, because most of the babies die very young,
right?
Or like most of the mothers aren't able to carry the kids to term. So like there's, on the one hand, there's that element of life being very precious, and you kind of see that in terms of like the Traxxers also, like that, like, even in death people can provide something to those who live.
Right.
And then the flip side of it all being R2, where like life just has no value. It's just this mass of people who are just surviving. And then the way in which with Hux, like they can all just be eliminated, wiped away.
It's like you have this feeling of like everything that all those people fought for doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
It's over. I'm getting sad.
Yeah. It's a very grim book.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like this must be the darkest Star Wars book, at least in canon, that I can remember.
Yeah, it's pretty grim.
Yeah.
It's pretty bleak.
Yeah.
You know, and that's pretty much where the Phasma story ends. There's a few other things that we kind of learn about her past, and we can kind of talk about those as they intersect with the B plot. That is not the B plot, but I want to get into that B plot. That's not a B plot, because we've glazed over that as we kind of told the Phasma story linearly and talked about it. But I want to get back to some of the Vi Cardinal stuff, because they have a very interesting dynamic and relationship. I mean, Vi Moradi is herself a very interesting character, because she is this very like, you know, what am I looking for? Kind of sardonic character. She's very quippy.
Yeah.
And you kind of see that early on, like in her interactions with Cardinal, like her nicknaming him Emergency Break because of the Red Arbor. Like, I love that.
She's so like, it's like a defense mechanism, right? Like she's so like, you know, in this situation, she doesn't know if she can get out of it. She's like, I'm going to crack a joke because, like, this is who I am. I love that. I love this character so much. I'm glad that, first of all, I'm glad that we got her in another book after this. I'm also glad that she's, like, a character in Galaxy's Edge. Like, she's just become such a huge staple of this era. It's just so great. We need more.
Yes. Yeah. Vi Moradi is an absolutely delightful character. And so, you know, one of the things that you see in their interaction and their dynamic as Vi Moradi's kind of telling this story under duress is you see she's trying, you know, I talked about this towards the beginning, is that she's using this both as a way to string out the interrogation so that Cardinal doesn't kill her on a very kind of practical level, just kind of keep feeding him chunks of information. Mm-hmm. And like you get this when there's like, when you get a chunk of the Phasma story and then you get the cutback where like she's been telling a whole chunk of the story and then it cuts back to Cardinal's like, this is useless. Like, why'd you tell me all this? Like, this is not gonna help me. And he's like, hang on, like you need that to get to the next part of the story. Right. And he's like, okay, go on.
Yeah. And there's that one part where like he actually goes and gets her food and like something to heal her a little bit, because he's like, I kind of need her.
Yes. Yeah. You get those little moments where like there's the kind of third player in the story, which you get the Cardinal's droid. It's like, he's also got like a little droid there. And like the droid's sort of like, you know, like, I guess you kind of have to feed her to keep her going. Like, okay, fine. Like, I'll get you something. Like, and yeah, so she's doing it in one way to kind of save her own skin and keep herself alive long enough by stringing Cardinal along. But then she's also using that time in this way to kind of try to probe Cardinal.
Yeah.
Because you know, like, she has bits of information left. So she reveals, for example, that she knows that Brendel Hux is dead, and Cardinal's kind of shocked by that. He's like, not even people in the First Order really know about that, or, like, what happened? Like, that's a really tightly kept secret. Like, how do you know about that? Mm-hmm. And then she's trying to kind of probe about his past, because she knows a few things about him. Like, the thing that we learn is that he had originally come from Jakku, and he had been part pretty much of, like, the first generation of kids that Brendel Hux had gathered into and kind of trained up as the kind of first gen of the First Order stormtroopers. Mm-hmm. And so he had kind of grown up under Brendel, who had been almost this kind of surrogate father figure for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I really liked what we learned about the First Order in this book, because, like, you know, we've gotten bits and pieces of, like, its backstory and how it formed and how it works. But to see it from, like, the perspective of someone who grew up in it, it's heartbreaking when you get to the parts about how, like, he was, like, seemingly, like, the most important one and mm-hmm. then stopped being that. Like, that's all he ever knew. And then, like, someone who is not part of this system just came in and, like, took that all away from him. Like, I kind of feel that. Like, I've been in positions where, like, things have just... that similar things have happened that way. It doesn't feel good, but, like, the way he goes about it is, like, he wants revenge in the sense that, like, he has to prove that she's not following the rules. It, knowing that if he's ever to confront her, Phasma doesn't follow the rules a lot more than people would think.
Yeah, precisely. And the thing that really comes out with Cardinal is that he is very much a true believer in the First Order. Like, he genuinely believes that the First Order is making the galaxy a better place. Yeah. Like, you know, we talked about in the context of Brendel Hux, where he's talking about, oh, the First Order is bringing order and prosperity to the galaxy. And you say, like, well, you look at him and it's like, okay, this is being very cynical because, like, this is a kind of head honcho guy. Like, he knows what's going on. Like, Cardinal really believes these things. Like, he really genuinely thinks that the First Order is a source of good in the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. Which is really important. It's really important to have that perspective because a lot of times, you know, Star Wars is more than just good versus evil. Like, sometimes the people who are on the side that you might consider the evil side or the dark side or whatever might actually genuinely believe they're doing the right thing. They may not always go about it, like, in the most, like, respectable way, but, like, they genuinely think what I'm doing right now is making the galaxy better. And, like, that's the most heartbreaking thing about it. And I think, like, that's something that really both sets apart the First Order and kind of, like, shows how much it didn't learn from the Empire, because they just, like, they want everyone involved to believe that, like, they're doing the right thing, even though it's just causing more destruction.
Yeah, precisely. And, you know, you get these really kind of tender moments with Cardinal where you get a couple description where, like, he goes to the cafeteria on the Star Destroyer and he sees the kids, the cadets that he's training. Mm-hmm. And you get these moments inside Cardinal's head where, like, he knows all the kids and he knows all their names and he knows little things about them. He's like, oh yeah, there's that guy, like, he's doing really good in training, or, like, he's the kind of, like, he's like this other one's, you know, this one's an up and comer and, like, really trying to assert herself. And, like, he just has little notes and he, like, keeps track of the kids and he knows which ones are doing good and which ones are, you know, maybe struggling on certain things. Like, he really cares about them.
It really makes you, like, really, really feel for him as a character, because, like, he really is just, like, in some ways he really is doing good. You know, think about these kids who were taken from their families and are now here and are being trained to fight for the First Order. Like, they have somebody essentially sort of looking out for them. Like, that's kind of nice.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, like, that also gets to his motivations and to his animosity towards Phasma, where it is slightly distinct. Like, it is a little distinct from the kind of traditional Darksider motivation of, oh, I just want to, like, I want to just elevate my own position, or, like, I'm just trying to knock down the person who's one peg above me, or kind of jockey myself for my own power. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of that in Cardinal's motivation, as we've talked about, like, that he's the kind of fallen star, mm-hmm. and, like, he wants to be the number one guy again. But then there's also the motivation of where he genuinely believes that Phasma is a kind of cancer on the First Order and a threat to the good that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is motivating why he wants to take her down.
Yeah. Yeah, he really thinks that, like, by kind of removing her, he can kind of restore order to the First Order.
Yeah. And so, and you know, you get this conversation, you know, you get a little bit of that in his conversation with Vimerati, where he starts kind of, you know, talking about how the resistance is all about anarchy and fomenting chaos in the galaxy, and the First Order is trying to, you know, restore good government and all of that. Mm-hmm. And what starts to happen over the course of the story is you start to see Cardinal's faith start to be shaken.
Mm.
And, you know, the kind of key moments, the things that really kind of break it for him happen towards the end, when it gets to particularly the story around Brendel Hux's death. Because as I mentioned before, it had been this kind of well-kept secret within the First Order that he was dead, and particularly how he died, and the fact that within the First Order, he had died kind of under mysterious circumstances. They didn't really know what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then Vimerati kind of comes up and says, like, well, I know what happened. Then, like, this is the kind of thing that she keeps kind of building up towards in her story. And what you pretty much learn, the kind of big twist and reveal, is that Phasma had snuck on board, when she left Parnassus, one of the gold beetles.
God.
And that she then at some point introduces it to Brendel Hux so that it does the same kind of exploding, dissolving thing. I think there's a description of like Brendel Hux is in the Bacta tank, and then he just like becomes the Bacta. Like, he just explodes in the Bacta tank.
I hate it. I hate it so much. Like, they need to like somehow reintroduce these beetles into another story, because like, if you want more horror in Star Wars, like, this is how you do it, man.
Exactly. And, you know, Vi has like one of the beetles, and she's telling Cardinal, like, I can help you prove that, you know, this is how Phasma did it. And like, here's, you know, here's the evidence that you're going to need. And this is at the point that Cardinal's like, okay, I got her. Like, I got the information. I know what happened. And then there's this scene where he runs off to Armitage Hux, and he goes to him in his quarters, and he says, like, I know what happened to your dad. Like, he was murdered. Phasma did it. Here's how she, like, I know how she did and all of that. And then Armitage just pretty much like, yeah, I know. Like,
oh, God.
We figured it out. Like, he, like, we just wanted the old fart gone.
Hux, all this family. Jesus.
Yeah, they're just all, like, Armitage is just such a little shit. Yeah. Like, he's just such a, like, just asshole.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And this for Cardinal is just completely shattering.
Mm.
Because on the one hand, he thought he had Phasma. And, you know, he thought that somebody like Armitage was going to be, you know, was going to hear him out. And, you know, that he thought that the Armitage, like him, was a believer in the values of the First Order, and that he was going to expose Phasma, and that Hux was going to be like, okay, yeah, we can't have her around. She's a danger. And then that revelation is, oh, he's pretty much the same way she is. It is just all this naked will to power, amoral, nothing else matters.
This breaks him.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, as you said before, he has complete faith in the First Order and what they're supposed to believe in and what they're supposed to do for the galaxy. And then to have this moment to realize, like, none of that, like, not everyone believes what I believe. Like, the First Order is not what I thought it was. And, you know, it's kind of like you spend your whole life holding on to something and believing like this is the thing that is going to save you. This is like the thing that's going to make everything better, to realize like it's not what you thought. That's devastating. Like, I think we've all had those moments at some point or another. Like, you have this thing that you have all of your faith in, and then it's not going to help you.
Yeah, precisely. And I think that's, you know, that's something that you see in, I think, in a lot of different Star Wars stories. of that revelation. You know, you can think back to, let's say, like, the prequels, and, like, you think about, like, let's say, like, the Revenge of the Sith and that Padme moment, she's like, what if the democracy we're fighting for no longer exists? That kind of shattering of the faith moment where, like, you believed in this thing and you committed your life to this thing, and then all of a sudden the rug is pulled out from under you. It's something that you get in a lot of the stories of the genre of, like, ex-imperials.
Yeah.
Whether with a, let's say, with a Sienna Ree or an Iden Versio or a Tala most recently at this recording in Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Right.
And I think, you know, at the risk of making it sort of too contemporary or connecting to the real world, which, you know, this is something that I do on the show a lot. So, you know, it's relevant to bring in.
There
so,
you go.
You know, like, I think there's a lot of modern salience now when you think about the world of and the proliferation of, let's say, online conspiracy theories and all that, and, like, people, you know, and accounts and, you know, profiles of people who are, like, Q-pilled or something, you know, who, like were, like, deep in QAnon or something, or, like, were part of January 6th or something like that, who, like, were committed to all of these stories and these things about here's how the world works and here's how everything is, and then the revelation of, like, oh, this was all just bullshit.
Have you done an episode about, like, conspiracy theories?
I have not. I do want to.
You really should.
Yeah.
I'd listen to it.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
But yeah, I think there's a lot of contemporary salience with a kind of cardinal character of this person who is taken in, and he is fed this story, he is fed this narrative, and he buys in it wholesale, and then gets to a point where he just has the full-blown reality just cold cock him in the face.
It's so, like, you just see him progressively just sink lower and lower as this book goes on. And it's like, you know, we won't get into, like, what the next book covers, but it's like, it's just so tragic to see, like, he's going to have to build himself up somehow. But, like, what does he have to turn to at this point? Pretty much nothing, because, like, he was clinging to this hope that he could, you know, expose Phasma and get his spot back, maybe, or, you know, restore this order to this organization that he doesn't know anything other than this. And he's just faced with just this endless darkness now, because, like, what is there? What matters?
Yeah, precisely. And, like, that's kind of the big confrontation that comes at the end of the story, you know, once you get the confrontation between Cardinal and Phasma, where it is not just this conflict between two people, two individuals, but it is also this conflict of, I don't know, life philosophies in a way, in the sense of, like, you know, and this is something that is, you know, in Star Wars, and it's also out, you know, outside of Star Wars, which is, like, the confrontation of, like, dealing with someone who just manifestly refuses to play by the rules.
Yeah.
Because I think that's something, I think maybe Vimarati says, or somebody else is like that Phasma will always win because she will do whatever it takes.
Yeah.
And that kind of confrontation between somebody who's got morals and rules and they're bounded by versus somebody that isn't. Like, I immediately think of, like, a Dark Knight. Like, that movie, like, that whole movie, that confrontation is, like, how does somebody like a Batman or, like, a Commissioner Gordon, these people who are bounded by rules and they have lines that they won't cross, how do they deal with, like, a Joker who doesn't have any of those lines and is willing to do anything? And that's Phasma in the position of the story, that she will do anything. She will break any rule. She's bounded by nothing.
Yeah, which makes Cardinal's attempt to defeat her that much more interesting.
Yes.
Because it's probably the one time that he's gone against his own philosophy of always follow the rules. It doesn't work out for him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He is bested by Phasma. And then you have what is in there, a very interesting moment. And this you get something that's really kind of a through line through the holster that we haven't really touched on, which is you get this moment where Phasma kind of has him on the ground, like has him pretty much KO, like TKO, and she removes her helmet and kind of exposes herself in that way. And that's a kind of big part of the Phasma story, because that, you know, going back to the kind of A plot of this book is even before she joins the First Order, something that is noted is her propensity to be masked. So when you first meet her, when she's a Skyre warrior, she's got some sort of, you know, homemade mask or whatever that she wears as a warrior. And then she subsequently goes on to wear one of the helmets of one of the Forest Order stormtroopers. Like, she just puts on some armor of one of the fallen troopers who dies. And so that notion of masking her face is also something that's really important in the story.
Yeah, it's, you know, there are a lot of different ways to look at that, especially in The Last Jedi, because her helmet is broken. So you see part of her face at one point, and, you know, it's almost like you could even interpret it as like she doesn't want to see herself as anything other than like possibly like the warrior that she wants to be. Like, she will hide behind that armor, those masks, whatever she can, because like what she wants to be perceived as, even if it's not like exactly who she is, like that is how she kind of forces herself to be that. Is like wearing that armor, wearing that mask all the time is like, this is who I am, and no one can question that because you can't see what's behind it.
Yeah, precisely. And I mean, this could be an episode in all and of itself, which is about masks and Star Wars.
Oh my God, I love that.
And how they function. Like, at the time of this recording, a few hours before, I rewatched The Village Bride. Mm. And like, there's a whole mask story in there with the character of F, where she starts off the story and she's wearing this kind of half mask over part of her face. And then her kind of coming around to embracing being a Jedi at the end comes with her removing the mask. Mm-hmm. And coming out of hiding as this kind of metaphor. And then they're all sort of like, the big one is Darth Vader, whether it is the cracking of the helmets twice, or if it is the help me take this mask off at the end of Jedi, all the stuff with Kylo Ren. Like, masks have this whole role in Star Wars around identity and like projecting a particular identity, trying to suppress another kind of identity or aspect of yourself. Yeah, and you kind of see that with Phasma, where in all of the different modes that you get her, whether Skyre warrior, whether, you know, where she's like starting to kind of become a part of the first, the kind of amalgamating herself to the First Order, and then when she gets her own armor, the chrome armor, which we'll talk a little bit more about the chrome armor. We're going to talk more about the chrome armor in a sec. Like, that is her, as you said, that is her attempting to project a certain version of herself out into the world and how she wants to be perceived. And also the fact that, not just that, but also it is signaling the fact that she does not want to be perceived as she is.
Right. Right. Like, she has created the identity that she wants to be known as. And like, she, no one will ever know her as anything else. Because with Phasma, it's so much of what drives her is this quest for control. And like, if she can control like how everyone else is seeing her, then like, she has that. No one can take that away from her.
Yeah, precisely. And then ultimately, you know, the story there kind of ends with Cardinal is left for dead. Vimarati is able to escape the interrogation chamber where she had been, and she helps Cardinal escape from the First Order ship and kind of takes him away. And then the kind of the end of the book is we get the epilogue.
Oh my God.
And in there we get the story of where does Phasma's chrome armor come from. So
okay, so like, you get, first of all, Star Wars book epilogues are some of my favorite things. You have the Queen Shadow epilogue, which broke me in half. You have this one. There's so many examples of like these epilogues just do such a good job. Oh, the Solo novelization also. I won't spoil that one because it's just too good. But the epilogues are just, you know, epilogues, they don't necessarily need to be there, but they're these tags that really just kind of like punch you. And this is one of those, because you find out that she goes back to like basically create this armor for herself. And I think, again, this is another one of those things I just think about way too often because, like, she did that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you get this whole kind of dramatic story where she goes back to Parnassus and she digs out from beneath the sands, beneath the dirt, the shuttle that Brendel Hux had arrived in. Mm-hmm. And it was this kind of chrome ship. I think it is revealed like it was one of Palpatine's ships. Like it's pretty much like a Nubian ship. Mm-hmm. So like Padme's ships in the prequels, pretty much that. And then she takes hunks of the metal and she brings them to one of the kind of defunct factories that are on Parnassus. And then the machines there assemble the suit, like in the style of a First Order stormtrooper armor. Pretty much, she pretty much has it like 3D printed. Like would essentially
pretty much.
Yeah, she pretty much like 3D prints her own armor using this chrome.
Like, who does that? The answer is Phasma does that. But man,
yes, yeah. And then she pretty much just gets back in her TIE fighter and leaves. And it's this really interesting moment because, like, yeah, as we kind of talked about, and you sort of mentioned, like a big part of Phasma's story is her trying to get rid of anyone or anything that has any connection to her past. Mm. So whether that is killing her brother Keldo, that is her motivation for killing Brendel Hux, because he knows her story. He knows her past, where she came from, and that's why she wants to kill him, so that he can't in any way leverage that against her or anybody else can find out anything. But then she has this moment where she goes back to her past. And she retrieves this artifact of her past and makes it a part of her.
She can't get rid of who she is. Like, think about bringing the beetle back. Think about the armor. She, no matter how hard she tries to completely get away from where she came from, who she was before, she can't do it. There's part of her that cannot let go. And then she goes back. She makes that armor. It is a part of her forever. So no matter what, she's always going to be exactly who she's always been. And I bet she hates that.
Yeah. You know what I just thought about now? Like a kind of a parallel moment.
I saw your face and I was like, what's he thinking about?
You're doing this. It's this and it's the end of Victory and Death. Vader finding the lightsaber. He goes and digs it out.
Oh, why you gotta hurt me like that?
It is these two characters who try to walk away from who they are or who they were. Mm. And then they just, they go, something brings them back.
Well, that's the thing about trying to walk away from who you've always been is who you were shapes who you're going to become. Mm-hmm. You can't ever get away from it. No matter how far away you walk, no matter how far you fly away in your TIE fighter, who you were before you became who you are, the reason you are who you are now is because of who you were. There is no escaping it. I can't think of the word I want to use, but that's how it goes. There is no way to completely cut yourself off from where you came from, because without that, you wouldn't be here.
Yeah. Yeah, it is and every character that we see in Star Wars, it tries to do that, ultimately fails. Anakin tries to do it when he becomes Vader. And he thinks that, you know, if I get rid of Obi-Wan, if I get rid of Ahsoka, if I get rid of all of these ties to where I was as Anakin, I can leave that behind me. And he fails. Kylo Ren tries to do it. If I kill my dad, if I attempt to kill my mom, if I kill my uncle Luke, then I can get rid of Ben Solo and I can just be Kylo Ren. And he can't do that. All these characters are trying to do that. Phasma tries, like, none of them can kill their pasts.
I legitimately just came up with my next podcast episode idea. There it is.
Hell yeah.
This is just, like, such a productive conversation.
Yes, it is. Oh, and for the record, for those of you listening, I teased her upcoming podcast, Now This Is Lit. I named it. Just put that on my record here.
You shared it.
I came up with the name. So look at me here, just having positive externalities, contributing to the podcasting world here.
I will always give you credit for naming it, because, like, there's no way I could have ever come up with something that brilliant. Like, I'm not good at naming things. You're so good at it. I mean, you named this podcast, your name to my upcoming podcast.
Thank you.
I was going to say something else and I stopped for reasons. I'll tell you later.
Okay. All right. Sure. And so, yeah, that kind of brings us to the end of the book, pretty much. So final thoughts, conclusions, words.
I first read this book. Now that I'm thinking about it, I think it was 2018. I must have read it because I would have read it after The Last Jedi. So I think it took me a while to get around to this. So it has been about 4 years. In another 4 years, I'm going to read this book again. I want to know why. Because I found this out recently about myself. Maybe I knew it already. I forget a lot of what happens in the books that I read. Listen, there are a lot of Star Wars books. There are a lot of books in general, and I read a lot of them. It is very easy to forget little things that happen. Like you remember the big points. You remember the exploding people in the sand. You never forget. Hashtag never forget.
Yes.
But you do forget the certain like little things that make the story even better than you remember. I like that. I like being able to come back to a Star Wars book even, or a story in general, years after the fact, when I don't remember a lot of the little details that make it good, and re-experience it. Now, maybe not for the first time, but like there is value to rereading. And I know there are a lot of books and there's not a lot of time. I don't have a lot of time for this, but it's so valuable. Like I have gotten so much more out of this book this time around than I did the first time. I think the first time I read it in like a day. I read it over Thanksgiving, I remember, because we were doing family photos and my mom was like, put the book down, we have to take
That's very on brand.
I am who I am. I'm not trying to run from my past. This is just who I've always been. No, this book, you know, as we said, if you're looking for a really, really dark, I would say gory, kind of just terrifying Star Wars book, it's so good, but it is also all of those things. You know, if you want more Phasma, obviously you'll get that. Not as much as you might want to, but that's the whole point. It's so good. And like, I know because I've read Delilah Dawson's books before, like she's a great writer, but you really don't see that until you just really dive into a book like this. Highly recommend just in general, but also the audiobook is great. So if you have not, if you've read it before and have not listened to it, do that.
All right. Yeah. So I'm going to, you know, for my kind of wrap up thoughts, I'm going to second a lot of what you said in terms of this is a really a top tier Star Wars book, in my opinion. I think it is a great book for learning more about this particular character that, as we talked about at the top of the show, you don't get a lot of in the movies. But yeah, you get a lot of great backstory. You get a very, very unique kind of Star Wars story because, you know, the thing about Star Wars is, you know, it constantly, Star Wars storytelling is constantly pulling and being inspired by different genres out there, whether it is classic Asian cinema, whether it is Westerns, and a story like Phasma is very much informed by your Mad Max, post-apocalyptic, sci-fi, dystopian fiction. It is very much in that slot and is really kind of taking inspiration from that. So if you are somebody who likes those type of stories and, you know, wants the kind of Venn diagram intersection between that sort of genre of storytelling and Star Wars, Phasma fits right in that Venn diagram middle of that.
Yeah. And I did kind of, I think, mention this a little bit before, but like also if you kind of want to know a little bit more about the First Order and kind of like how it runs from like sort of an internal perspective, this is a really good book for that. And I kind of like forgot how much of that you get in here. Because there's so much about like the First Order, we don't have a lot of like of the beginning times. So we're getting more of that. Read Shadow of the Sith. That's also good. But this book is also good for that too. So.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Like you get a lot of really interesting bits about, you know, we already talked a little bit about the training program and the kids who are in the First Order, but then you get also little details about like the propaganda tapes that they listen to while they're sleeping. So that they're being indoctrinated pretty much 24/7. And you learn about like the food they eat. So you get all these kind of mundane details about what it's like to actually live as a soldier. So you get that stuff. And then also, you know, we've of course talked about them in the context of the conversation, like the book on the one hand adds to a character that we already have, Phasma, but also introduces you to new characters.
Yeah.
Who are very compelling. I mean, we've talked about Vimerati. Cardinal's a very interesting character and his background and story and the trajectory that he goes on. So it is a valuable book for that too, for getting these new characters that you don't get elsewhere. I mean, you have Black Spire, which is like, it's not a sequel per se in the kind of traditional sense that we would think of, but it is a kind of sister book to it, which I still need to read.
How have you not read
it? I don't know. I really want to read it because I know pretty much it kind of de facto continues the story.
Yeah, it's like the closest thing you would want to a sequel because like Phasma is like an almost perfect book on its own. But like certain characters' stories do get to continue and I think that's pretty valuable. I think the best Star Wars stories are the ones that kind of mix familiar characters with new characters. So like you've heard of this character or you like this character, but they're surrounded by characters you may not know as well or at all. I think that's like the perfect blend of like merging the two, because then it's a way of like, I guess, more subtly expanding the universe, because that's what these books do, but often using characters that we already know to kind of like expand and show like what different parts of the universe are like.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, the moral of this episode is go read Phasma. I know we talked a bunch about what happens in the book, but there's a lot we didn't get to. Yeah. And there's a lot of nitty-gritty in the middle, of, you know, a lot of the meat that we didn't get into. So there's still a whole ton to be garnered from reading the book, even if you've listened through this episode and already know kind of the big points.
Yeah, I mean, there is no way we could have touched on everything because we'd be here for like 4 hours. It's a big book. It's a good book. But it's like, I think the audiobook is what, like 12 hours?
Yeah, something like that,
It's a long boy.
It very much is a long boy. So. So, yes, do go pick it up if you have not yet. So, all right. So, on that note, I think we will wrap up this conversation. Thank you, Meg, for coming back for a third time.
This has been so fun, and you made so many movie references that I did not understand, but like that happens daily. So like, welcome listeners to.
I'm working on it, folks. Like I got a list.
There's
like,
a whole list. We just keep rewatching shows though. It's fine.
Yeah. I play a lot of Lego Skywalker Saga.
You have so many bricks. You're doing such a great job.
Thank you.
I'm so proud of you. This was a great conversation, not just because it's you, but because I read this book before I got into podcasting. So like, I literally have never sat down and talked through with anyone. I was so excited to do that just because I've loved this book. And when I read it, I had no one to talk about it with really. Like I wasn't really into like Twitter or anything, believe it or not. I know I'm there all the time now. I'm trying not to be, it's hard. But yeah, so to finally, I know this is a quote unquote old book, but like to finally sit down and talk through it and really like analyze it. Cause I really haven't, it was fun. I love this character. I love this book when it came out. I loved having a really good reason to reread it. And, I will be rereading it again.
All right. So last thing, plug away. Where can people find you?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is I have a podcast coming out very, very soon called Now This Is Lit, named by the person sitting next to me right now, because I came to him and I said, hey, I want to do a book podcast. Help me name this show. It is, I would say, unlike any Star Wars books podcast that you've probably heard. It's a mix of a little bit of everything. There's book discussions like this, but there's also interviews. There's also like deep dives into how Star Wars stories are made. I'm very excited about that. I can't tell you who I'm talking to yet, but it's some people that you're going to be very interested in hearing from. So it's going to be probably the most fun project I've ever worked on. And don't worry, I will have Devor on the show at some point. We're going to talk about Lost Stars. So that will be, I'm sure, a very fun time.
Oh, yeah, folks. Like, you think I love this book that we were talking about, Phasma? Wait till you hear me talk about Lost Stars.
And it has been even longer since I read that book. And that's a big book also.
That is a very big book. Yes.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to diving back into that one. Yeah. So if you follow me on Twitter at MacDowell, that is where you will probably find all the things you need to know about that show. It comes out officially August 2nd. I might have a surprise a little bit before that. We'll see. But I am very excited, and I think you guys are really going to like it.
All right, Meg, thank you for coming back.
Thank you for inviting me. I didn't have to go very far, so it's great.
So, what to expect on the next episode? Episode 41 will drop on August 11th. And on that episode, I'm going to be talking about another Star Wars book, another long boy. That is Adam Christopher's book, Shadow of the Sith, which released at the time of this recording a few months back. And that is the book that gives us the story teased in The Rise of Skywalker of Luke and Lando's adventure to chase down Ochi of Bestoon. We get a lot about the story of Exegol and the Sith cultists there, and we also get some great backstory to Rey and her parents. And joining me for that conversation will be Eli from Star Wars in a Galaxy. So do make sure to tune in for that. That is going to be a great conversation. Until then, make sure you're subscribed to the show. Please rate and review the show if you're able to do so. If you're not already following the show on Twitter, you can do so at A Larger View Pod. And until next time, look for the Force, and you will always find it.